following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
It's the Stone Cold and Jackal Show.
Really? That's what you came up with for our intro?
Stevie B!
See, there, isn't that amazing?
Hey,
that was
buddy.
That was the highest you've ever introduced
Steve.
Me. That was amazing. Bradford Anderson, what's happening, brother?
How are you, man? It's so good to see you.
I know. It's great to see you.
And there's something odd. Just being in front of a mic, having a cup of coffee.
I know. We're back.
Oh.
And you're alive.
I'm alive.
After staying in a hostel, which I warned you against.
Two nights in a hostel, and I survived. I'm not terribly well rested. Here's the thing. Pros and cons, hostel-wise?
I have a lot of cons.
Okay.
Give me one pro.
Intermingling with people you don't know. Meeting new friends.
If you like that, yeah.
Okay. The opportunity for new experience, okay, all that, whatever.
That's not.
Now let's go into the cons.
So we're going right into it.
Some people snore.
A lot of people snore.
A lot of people don't have controls over their alarms in the morning. A lot of people don't have the best hygiene.
That's true.
And a lot of people don't have to get up and go to work in the morning.
Okay, there you go.
So I knew this was a younger man's game. I knew it.
You knew it.
And I thought I could cling to my young man game. Not that I've ever had any sort of game.
Just let it go.
But
let it go.
I think the experiment is over.
It's over. I'm not letting you do it again, and nor is your wife.
That's fair.
So,
and I appreciate that. Last week, I just kind of was like, you guys can't tell me what to do.
Now I'm going to tell you because it's not good, dude.
No.
And honestly, there's not really a safety issue. I joke about that because there's a horror movie named after Hostel where everyone in the hostel gets killed.
Right.
But the truth is, it's just not.
Yeah. It's
you're not getting a good night rest. You're not. It's just not good.
I thought it could be part. I think it could help my creative process. Like if I come down for auditions and I stay in a hostel, it just like I'm getting all these influences and getting all these ideas, and I'm just part of the world instead of locked up in like my own private Airbnb somewhere or something like that. I thought maybe it would feed me as a human being, and it just depleted me as a human being.
It just took the energy. And you hear somebody laughing with us right now,
which is wonderful.
Which is wonderful because he's so gracious to even come in and do this interview.
I think we were surprised he said yes.
I was surprised. Well, it's amazing because I'm surprised he actually answered the phone. I called him, and I know he doesn't have my number in his phone, and he answered.
Wow.
Which is amazing.
That is amazing.
So
did he answer accusatorily?
No, he didn't. He was very nice.
Who's this?
No, he was not. No, he was not
of course he was.
At all. So
all right.
It was like, hello.
He was like, hello?
Yeah. Hello?
Whose number is this? But without further ado,
we have Max Gale with us.
Max Gale!
Yeah!
He's the best.
AKA Maxwell Gale. You've gone by different versions of your name in the past, right?
Yeah, depending on, because my name is Maxwell Gale. I'm a junior, actually.
Oh, okay.
And kind of in the moment, you know, at times, not really ever having really decided, am I going to be Max Gale, which is, you know, kind of what I've gone by growing up and all that.
Right.
Actually, first I wanted to say, the thing about, I mean, if your other alternative is the park bench, then a hostel is like
really.
It's a
huge step up.
It's a step up. Yeah.
It's all luxury. Yeah.
It is true, Max. It's all perspective, right?
But it does sound exactly like another word that's spelled slightly different, which is hostel.
Yeah.
So there you got a little, because I'm big into rhyme. You know, there's something about words that rhyme.
Yeah.
There's a resonance with rhyme and all my writing is in rhyme, which turned into song lyrics.
Oh, that's something
I
want to talk about.
Do you
never introduce yourself as Maxwell?
I think it's such a cool. It's a cool name.
I have friends who call me Maxwell all the time, I used to get on the Barney Miller set. I got Maxilla because there was a big Jewish Maxilla.
Maxilla,
Max in the Bubala, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you worked on Barney Miller, you learned about Hasarai and Fakakta and all that. You know, it was all it was just a part of the
lingo,
the
culture of the circle. But
we did a little bit of research on you.
A little bit, yeah.
That's, I mean, the interweb is such a lovely place.
Well, there's so much to talk about.
Well, yeah.
Because the amazing work, and we'll get to that, that he's doing here is right. is it's honestly mind-blowing.
Yes.
What he's doing. And but there's so much. It's like, you know, when people come on daytime, oh, who's that? Oh, that's Max Gale. Oh, is this his first job?
I know.
You know, people have no idea that you've been working for 40 years.
Yeah,
you know, in
I
this
had
business.
Some gaps in there where I stepped out for other things, but
other
yeah.
things
know.
Are good. They keep they keep the other things fresh. We were just talking
yeah.
about that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yes, to your point about being in a hostel, cause you'd be with, you know, yes,
theater in the hostel,
theater, hostel, theater, mm-hmm.
hostel.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. So you're a Midwestern boy, is that right?
I'm from Detroit. From
Detroit.
What we call
Detroit.
Downriver Detroit.
Downriver Detroit.
Downriver Detroit. Because Detroit is it's on the Detroit River, the city of Detroit, which is really not a river; it's a strait.
Okay.
That's why when the French sailed through there and named everything.
Did they? And so it was actually Détroit?
They called it the Strait. Détroit, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a strait that runs between Lake St. Clair,
uh-huh.
kind of north, and then the river takes a bend. So actually the city of Detroit is north of the city of Windsor, the Canadian city of Windsor, which is across the bridge.
Right.
And then goes down into Lake Erie, and that downriver part is where the foundries were,
okay.
and then the Detroit Edison and Wyandotte Chemical, and all along the U.S. the United States side.
Okay, yeah.
Of the, and I grew up on an island called Gros Eel.
Oh, wow.
Big Island.
Big Island.
Because it was the biggest of a lot of small.
Really, you grew
islands
up on an island.
Kind of,
yeah. How exotic!
What is that population? What was your population?
It was a few thousand. It was
wow.
about the size of Manhattan.
So, was it a ferry over, or was
no,
there a bridge?
No, there were two bridges.
Okay.
There was the toll bridge at the north end of the island, which was owned by a family that lived on the island.
Oh, that's good business!
What a great business!
And they had this kind of rotating thing. So when the coal would come in to go down to Detroit Edison or something, that bridge would open up, and then there was the county bridge that had once been a railroad bridge.
Okay.
And it was the last bridge over to Gros Eel, and then there was a bridge of which now, as I grew up, there were only the pillars in the
yeah.
water, then to over to Stony Island and on over to Canada. But that was the last last stop on the Underground Railway for people who had escaped slavery,
yeah.
but they still weren't safe until they got to Canada because
right.
because the
Some
law
people still
said
feel
you had,
that way. You got to get to Canada.
Well, yeah, that's right. There's,
yeah.
there's it makes me think of my old bandmate in college, Jimmy Winchester, who changed his name to Jesse, but went north to Canada to avoid the draft and then just stayed up there and had a wonderful career as a singer songwriter,
wow.
you know, but
well, that's a cool name, Jesse
yeah,
Winchester.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah,
going to
yeah,
see him.
Yeah. he was from Memphis and one of his songs was, I'm going to stay with my feet in the South and my head in the cool blue North.
All right.
So,
there you go.
So, but anyway, that's where I,
yeah.
I grew up. My dad had a couple of businesses that because he had been a piano player, he had a booking agency where he would book the bands of guys who had been in his band.
Yeah.
And he had a couple of office supply stores that started with him taking over his uncle's office supply booth in the Penobscot building, the main office building in Detroit at that time.
Wow.
And, he was stationed in Gros Eel. There was a Navy base at the south end of the island. So those were the days where, you know, those old movies where the guy meets the girl at the coffee shop. Say, you seem like a sharp little girl.
Hey!
We ought to get married. Yeah, let's do that. What are you doing Tuesday? You know, it was that
right.
awesome.
That kind of life. So,
was that your parents' story just then?
That was pretty much, pretty much, yeah.
yeah.
Pretty quick met in April, married in May, engaged in May.
And you were born in July.
And I was pretty, you know, it timed out pretty well. But my mother had three sets of twins.
What?
So she had seven kids in 6 years.
Come on.
And
is she
five
a,
in three
Is she
years.
Sainted?
Yeah.
Because she should be. I mean, three sets of twins.
Yeah, you know,
What are the odds
I grew
of
up
that?
With, I mean, as I went through life and people would hear that, they'd say, oh my God, your poor mother. And I go like, what? You know? And then when I finally had one that I was there for, because
sure.
I have a daughter we have a great relationship now, but she was given up for adoption. It was kind of a one-night stand. I didn't ask for or wasn't offered more than just, can I pay for the home for unwed mothers? And eventually we connected. And, you
wow.
know, but so my daughter, India, who lives in Austin, Texas, and my daughter India has 15-month-old twin girls.
Oh,
so when so she said when she
family.
Told me, she said, "You know, Dad, you're on the hook here." So, and I get down there as often as I can, and I have a great time with them. But yeah. I get that two at the same time is more than twice.
Double trouble, one, man. You know. It is double
once
trouble.
Once they maybe get to an age where they can play together.
What, like 18? Dude, because let me tell you something. I have a 4-year-old, right? And you got two of them. Well, if I had two of my daughter, I don't know. My wife would cut my package off for good.
All I know is that my 4-year-old, all she does is play with my 7-year-old. They disappear.
That's amazing. Yeah.
And so I wonder if twins, once they get to an age where they can play together. But I can imagine those first couple years are
well. They have times where they play together just great, and then the other times where they're totally the other one is the you know, and even early on when one would start having some kind of meltdown,
right?
The other would have this look like, what? What's her problem?
What's your problem? You know? Yeah. That's awesome.
So we, as a kid, were you helping out at all your multiple family businesses? What was Kid Max like?
Well, I worked in my dad's office supply store on like vacations or summers, so I had
great
some
vacation.
Money, you know,
that
relative to others, you know. My dad was a hard worker, and that was you know, I did lawn jobs and sort of stuff.
Did you get to go to the clubs where he booked his musician friends into?
To some extent. I mean, I grew up around that. The feeling, you know, musicians being around, being over, I grew up around, there was music in the house. We never listened to records.
Okay. It was just live.
For some reason. It was just, you know, everybody played something.
That's pretty neat.
I was kind of a slow start. It was my twin sister who learned the Moonlight Sonata and played the flute and, you know, she was tight with my dad.
Wow.
And I was more... Actually, when I think about it, my mother, who had been a swimmer, she'd been the New York State backstroke champion in high school.
Gee
and then
whiz,
she swam in the Billy Rose Aquacade, which was kind of like the hair of its time, the big hip production.
It sounds
Billy
super,
Rose was a big production.
Super hip.
Yeah. He had a kind of musical swimming show built around Esther Williams.
Oh, okay.
That, who was a movie star and a swimmer. And So she was the one that, you know, my dad was, it was fine if I was interested in sports, but I was always thankful I didn't have one of those dads that would be down at football practice, you know, well, when I played at Michigan. And
right. Yeah.
Second guessing the coach and all that kind of crap, you know, but.
Sounded like me.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
sounded like me 2 days ago.
Yeah. Well,
and I'm Ohio State guy, so please don't say Michigan again, Max. And here I'll have to ask you to leave.
Yeah. No, that was football.
A big did that rivalry ever? I mean, was that a big part of how you grew up? Was that Michigan Ohio State? Do you remember a lot about that?
Yeah, kind of. Again, it was not. You know, I remember going to Michigan games, but having to wear gray flannel pants, which I had. You know, it was a.
You had to wear
just if we were going to go to a game, which didn't happen all that often, but it was kind of dressing up, you know, where you're sort of Sunday.
Oh, you'd wear your Sunday best.
See, that's the difference between Michigan fans and Ohio State fans.
Oh.
Could be.
Right there. It's true.
Yeah.
Because they have the reputation
they were still painting their bare chest red back
being
then.
Being educated and dressing up for a game.
Right.
Meanwhile, us Ohio State.
Yeah. I remember.
Didn't wear shirts.
I graduated from high school in 1961. So that was when Ohio State, they ran the belly series. You had the quarterback right under the center, and a fullback and two halfbacks.
Yep.
It was really radical when they split out one of the halfbacks out to a wing, you know.
Oh, wow.
And the belly series, I played fullback. So that was it was a long kind of handoff that then you could pull out. So it was like a big,
it was just
kind of
like
hammering in the middle.
Yeah.
And then throwing it out and then the option.
Yeah.
You know,
it was three. It was always three downs and a pile of dust for Ohio State.
Yeah.
That's pretty much just
hammering.
Right. And then they, you know, would do the little option and they're like, what is that?
What is that?
But anyway, so growing up in Michigan, you had a great childhood. Do you remember everything that was?
Yeah. No, it was good. It was a time when most people, you know, they'd come out of, like, my dad had come out of the Depression. My mother was a little younger than people went through World War II.
Yeah.
People dealt with life pretty much by smoking and drinking, you know, the cocktail.
They're not
hour
terrible ways.
No, but you know, there weren't any, you know, there weren't shrinks on the radio.
Right. Yeah,
there
right.
was not there, you know, so there were issues that were related, I think, to the stress of that.
Sure,
my mother's dad had been a World War I psychological casualty, which is one thing is she planted in my brothers and my brains very early on. Don't go to war, mm-hmm. no matter what. So yeah, when that was going on around Vietnam, you know, I of course got that there was, you know, there were some questionable things about it, but I was not so clear on which way to go.
Sure.
As it just when opportunities came up to not go.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, some, hey, there's some guy over in the placement center, which is where people would do interviews with college seniors, you know, from some school in Grosse Pointe. You know, and I checked that out because you could get a deferment for teaching.
Right.
Ah.
So I taught ancient history and English to eighth grade boys in a school that didn't care that I had no teaching credentials, courses on ancient history. But I went to an Eastern college and I played sports. And that's what the dads who were sending their sons to this school, you know, wanted for their sons. So
coming up through like high school, were you involved in the arts besides music? Like, because when, you know, when you decided to go to college, what were you looking for in a college?
Okay, so I had you know, that was around. My mother had been an actress for a time. And so it was like not an odd thing, but it was my sister played Annie in Annie Get Your Gun, our senior play.
Fun.
You know, my sister did all of that. I was, I was in a rock and roll band. That was sort of 3 and 4 chord rock and roll.
Yeah, I love it.
Across the bridge.
I mean, honestly, you grew up during one of the greatest times in our history. I feel, I mean, just looking back, because just that music scene that came out of the 60s and 70s, it's amazing.
Yes.
It's amazing to look back.
Yeah.
Still, and those are truly the only songs that kind of hold up still. Today, or those, is that the,
well,
those decades?
They certainly do for me, because there are whole swaths of time where people say, let's look way back, and I think, well, I missed that, came long after I stopped, you know, listening.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, just that move that, and I got also our family for 3 years we went down for the second semester of the school year down to Florida. Where my mother had spent time growing up. She just got tired of
the cold.
Kids and colds. And,
yeah.
You know, you get the last one in the snowsuit and the next one's coming in and all of that.
Right, and then everybody has to go pee.
Yeah, so they so my folks got a home down in Delray Beach. They bought a house that was over on the if you know Florida at all, you know, you have like the east coast of Florida. Of course, there's the Atlantic Ocean. And then there's the beach communities that are – then there's the inland waterway a bit inside where people, you know, take their yachts up and down and out to the ocean and all. And that, so that's mostly people from the north that have the wealth to have a nice home down there.
Sure.
And then you have the main town of Delray Beach, and then you have the railroad tracks and a few blocks to the street that marked the division of Colored Town.
Okay.
And so we were actually a couple, we were inland from the railroad tracks, and they bought a duplex and put the stairs back in. My mother put a sign out, Gales by the Rails, no vacancy. We were kitty corner from the Episcopal Church, which we were next door to the Episcopal Rectory when I grew up. I went to the Protestant church on Grosse Isle.
Sure.
And then down the road a few blocks was the elementary school that we went to, which was mostly kids who are from year-long families in Delray Beach. So it was the first time I met kids whose parents were divorced. Never knew anybody whose parents were divorced.
Right.
I'm just living with my mom, you know. And then a lot of kids who would come in from inland, from the ranches and farms.
Right.
And they would either be the kind of red sons of red, basically redneck foremen or people
sure,
who ran the farms, you know, or primarily Hispanic people who worked on the farm. So that's who the school is for the first 2 years. And so I saw, you know, whites only drinking fountains. I had a gig sweeping the tennis courts, the clay tennis courts that have that kind of green sand on them, you know, and every night. So I would, and they were right over at the park that had all trees along one side. You couldn't, it was a long way to get around to. Right across the street was where the, a lot of the stores were. And that was this little business sector of Colortown. So I remember at night the sun would have gone down. I'm sweeping it and then sweeping off the tape and then setting out the sprinklers and just looking through there and listening and, you know.
How old were you then, Max?
I was, that would have been fifth and sixth grade, so 10 and 11. And then in the seventh grade, I went down there and they changed things around. So all of a sudden, it was now the junior high, the same physical school, but now it was the junior high. So I saw all these kids who had been going to the other elementary school. I remember getting there and they were electing the class president again because it was the beginning of the semester and some guy got elected. And that was I was always the class president.
Oh, that was your job.
And I remember standing in the back and watching and going, hey, I don't have to do this shit.
Hey, that's
I
great.
Really had that
you
feeling.
Were ready to pass on the
I
pass
didn't
on the
have
mantle.
To
that's
do
great.
It. And I was hanging out with a guy who ended up Jimmy Lorem. He could make me laugh.
Oh, yeah.
Good
old Jimmy Lorem.
Is this at all interesting?
Yes,
for sure. I haven't thought of these things.
No, it's great.
But that
man.
Was when Rebel Without a Cause came out.
Oh, you know?
So we all had switchblade knives and DA haircuts.
Oh,
and,
man.
You know, and at the end of that year, my folks decided maybe we won't be going down to Florida.
They're like, switchblades, we're going back to Michigan.
Yeah. I mean, just a little punk 12-year-old, but we were, so... Back when in Grosse Hill, there were some people kind of doing that, but they weren't the tough guys or whatever.
Sure. Yeah, the switchblades were the switchblade combs.
Yeah.
So, I loved those. I wanted one.
What
of those
year? Time. What? How old were you when you were in a band in your first band?
Probably 14 or 15.
And what did you play?
I played keyboard.
Yeah.
You know, somebody had shown me just a kind of a boogie woogie, 8-bar blues.
Yeah.
1-4-5 kind of deal. And I was just playing that. My dad came in. He just looked at me. He says, oh, yeah, okay, that's. And he said, so that's a C chord. That's an F chord. He kind of showed me chord. And then he began to show me a little more, you know. And then I'd grown up hearing what I hesitated a bit. Yeah, that was a time when a shift in music came out. Mm-hmm. And a lot coming out of the, rhythm and blues and other, you had. I can't say his name right now, and I have a friend who played with him. Let's say Tutti Frutti.
Oh yeah,
But you also had Pat Boone singing Tutti Frutti. It'll come to me in a minute.
Yeah,
because Little Richard. Yeah. How are we doing on this?
Oh, you're fine. I was going to look up Tutti Frutti.
Yeah. So I mean, I was hearing both of those.
Yeah,
I was hearing the what they called ethnic music or whatever, and then I was hearing the Pat Boone version of it,
right? Different,
totally different, and the music that was around and some people that would play for our school parties and stuff who were definitely coming out of country, out of Kentucky or somewhere, harmonica, guitar, and drums, or amplified, and I was. All that, the beat, and my dad used to say that, rock, they got a great beat.
Mm.
But at the same time, I had been exposed to a lot of wonderful songs from the 30s and 40s and all that era of songs. And I also heard songs that came out of Broadway shows that I didn't quite have that connection. So I had a broad kind of taste in music. And then, of course, when I got to college...
Right.
I remember being in college with Jesse, who was the first one that kind of turned me on to that Memphis
Jesse sound. Winchester, Jesse, we're talking
Jesse,
about now.
That's right.
Yeah, and then Bob Dylan. Like, I was junior in college, and Bob Dylan, that was when Bob went electric.
Mm.
It was kind of because my roommates were all into Dylan. They were like kind of upset that he went from folk.
He wasn't a purist now.
Right.
I was this like guitar. Detroit. I was kind of into this Detroit, years ago I ended up living across the street from Bob, although he had a big piece of property and I didn't see him very often.
Was that in Malibu?
In Malibu, yeah. But I remember because then he had gone into his, Christian time.
Oh.
And I remember, I just flashed back, as I remember when they were saying, how many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man, which was still in, I guess, his folk time. But that question, I remember thinking, I don't know how many, but I think it'll take you 35 or 40 years to get there, was kind of my feeling.
Right,
I didn't
sure.
quite feel like just because we're, you know, just because we can vote or or drink or whatever, it doesn't necessarily mean we're there yet.
We're there yet, yeah.
And he had come into, you know, singing, "There's strength in the things that remain." And it was, So, you know, life is a wonderful circle, I think, that we, this is why we sometimes look back and think we've gone in a totally different direction, but we're just going around the circle.
Yes.
And people that seem polarized, like we're into this time of polarizing everything, and every issue is reduced to a debate on the two sort of lowest.
Well, not sides, not even a debate, you know, anymore.
Yeah, hardly.
It's not even,
even
a debate. Yeah, you can't even. Yeah. We kind of talk about that, but we don't really talk politics. But it's like you can't even have a conversation anymore because it's so polarizing.
That
nobody even just can talk.
Yeah, it's very difficult.
You know, it's very it's sad. Mm-hmm.
And I spent a lot of, you know, I had of course this wonderful ride with Barney Miller. It was a great experience, and it wasn't like I was. Had this real direction of being an actor. I had found something that I could connect with feelings that I had not been able to connect with before. But I also connected up with the American Indian movement and things that were going on that really opened my heart or my eyes or whatever, my understanding spiritually.
Right.
To even really understanding the Christianity I'd been raised with, but understanding it on a deeper level. After the show ended, I did a couple of other things that were possibilities to do, you know.
Sure.
But I also got married and had a child, and when our daughter was 8 months old, I was doing a one-man play on Babe Ruth in New York.
Oh, wow.
That's cool.
That was a pretty cool project.
But wow.
During the night of the dress rehearsal, my wife went home from our late dinner, you know, not feeling well, and I got back to the hotel, and she was writhing in pain. Took her to the hospital. You know, it turned out that she had a tumor that had caused her appendix to burst. So was the beginning of our finding out a kind of 2-year journey of her hanging in as long as she could. And then I found myself a single mom.
Yeah.
So it wasn't our first choice.
Right.
I've gone on and. You know, I remarried. I've had other kids. It's not. I don't mean that to be a sad story, but it was certainly a change in time and life and
it's a big change.
Activism and all that. But as I came out of it, then you know, when I remarried, then I did another show. By then, the television had changed.
Mm.
You know, it's a Fox. Had come in with the Urban Network.
Okay.
Fox First was the Urban Network, so they had a lot of black shows.
Yeah.
And my wife was African-American, and my circle of friends, and my second wife was African-American. So it was something, television was just, it really changed a lot. I did do one show with Frank Zappa's two oldest kids, who were wonderful.
Yeah.
But it was just a different world, and I was different. And I kind of dropped out and said, what do I want to do? And it was when I actually saw the sort of the first browser and got, you know, the internet was becoming more accessible and computers were becoming more available. And I got into, we could have a better conversation as a to your point that we, as a species, and a lot of people felt like if we, a human being, we could talk to each other better. We don't have to have such differences. We can actually, you know, make the world a better place and all of that, which is not where it's ended up. I mean, there is a lot of that, but so and I kind of you know, saw one of the big issues would be for people to have access to these, you know, then we didn't have computers in our pockets,
right?
And so I got into this idea of LAP, local access places,
okay,
and programs and people and all the other, you know, but the basic idea that that all of our problems and all of our solutions are in our laps.
Mm.
And we are use that word. This is in your lap, and this is in our lap, and this is in the lap of mankind. It's a word we use in that way, you know.
Yeah.
So it just basically on that path, which I found, and I would leverage the fact I'd been in a very popular workplace comedy that was smart and well written. So I could get in and meet the Secretary of Education and HUD, and I could,
you
know,
access,
I mean, just about anywhere I went, because in those days there were so few channels compared to now.
Sure.
And so I got on that path, and I saw, gee, people have a hard time doing something that humans have been doing for a long time, which is just getting in a circle and having a conversation with a center instead of sides, where they're speaking into it and there's a sense of relationship. And that's kind of been my go-to, what different variations of that or ways to create that. And and yet here we are in this place where almost every, you can listen to this, like cable TV, they're not even talking to each other.
No.
And I think that's really sad. And I think, just to bring this around to us, one of the things about, I've discovered, I didn't really realize the great work people were doing in this daytime TV world.
Sure.
I didn't really understand what people are up against time-wise,
but
also what they're doing, and that there's people that get their storytelling fix, because we're storytelling creatures.
Yeah.
We're story people, species, and there's one thing about this part I've been playing in this storyline is that it touches people, across the board, left, right, black, white.
Absolutely.
100%.
Yeah.
I was watching some of your interviews on YouTube, and I know that human interaction is important to you from some of your interviews, and relationships are very important to you, and just how we communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And I was telling Bradford, I go, man, I could see from the interviews that why you're such an amazing actor is because you have such a great heart for people and to help people, and that comes through just in you normally, Max. You're such a great guy, and you have such a great energy, and just to be around you, and that you care so much about things. And I can tell that you being here, I've been here 20-something years, and, you came in, and obviously it was a huge story, and it's a lot of dialogue. It's different than what you were probably used to, except for when you did theater. You had to obviously memorize one-man show. But this is a one-man show every day for you.
Yeah.
So it's so inspiring to see that you still have that passion and fire for your work. Because when we're doing scenes and you're still asking questions, he's asking questions.
Yeah.
What are we doing? And they're like, Max, we don't have time for questions here.
Yeah, right.
So can you just, we hired you to be awesome. Can you just do that for us?
Just be awesome for us.
If I don't, there's certain things that if I don't have a certain amount of understanding of what's going on, I can't.
You can't. Well, everybody has their process, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And that's the truth. And we kind of talk about this. But
by the way, all those nice things you said, it takes one to know one.
Well, it's just, there's not a lot of stories that, there's stories that stand out that make a difference, but I've yet to see one, especially with the time and social media, of what this Alzheimer's story is doing for people. And just when we go on the road together and do our shows, people are talking about
it. We hear about it a lot.
We go, Sonny and Mike, and people scream, and like, oh, man, it's connecting to people in a different way than normal stories.
Uh-huh.
We all want relationship. We all want to watch that. And that's why we watch TV, is for relationships and story. And this has just connected people on such a different level, because no one ever brings awareness to this, to Alzheimer's. And I know a few people who've been through it, and it's a horrifying experience for the people who are still around and alive and have to go through it and watch their dad go through it, or their mom or a family member. It's awful.
Really hard on the caretakers.
It's interesting. We might have in daytime when we're doing, a serialized version over day, there may be a certain episode of a primetime show that, okay, let's make this episode about an Alzheimer's relationship or one of our main characters' relationship to their parents. But in daytime, we can play it out.
Yes.
And, go into different parts of what that relationship, how that relationship works that maybe people haven't seen dramatized before or not very often.
It's as close to living it as you can as an actor, I can imagine.
Yeah.
And first of all, I don't even know how, because we just glossed over Barney Miller and
I want to go back to that.
No, and DC Cab, because that was Mr. T. And I love Mr. T. So, but you've done so many cool projects. And it was funny. I was watching this clip from WizKids. That you did. Was that like 80?
That was right after Barney. That was the first TV show I did right after Barney.
Right after Barney. And it was awesome because he had this scene with a kid I recognized from back then who worked a lot. But it was totally your character as the Jackal.
Oh, no kidding.
He was a hacker back then. Uh-huh. He was like, well, I'll just break into the mainframe. I go, I'm watching freaking Max with the Jackal.
Yeah.
So it was great. It was an awesome show. But we can't gloss over that stuff. But I don't even know how did it start to come here? How did that whole process happen? Because I think that's interesting since, they might have said, oh, come in for a month. Was it a week? Was it a
I think it was like
story?
2.5 months or something like that.
And now how long have you been here now?
Well, that was, I guess, in January or February.
Oh, good gosh.
It was early in the year.
8 months, so 9 months.
It's gone longer than I think thought about. I asked Frank one time, I said, where is this going? So we're trying to figure it out. And I think that this is really a clear example because this is a collaborative thing. It's all in between people, even though they have awards and all of that kind of stuff. And and this has certainly been that in terms of the support and interaction and what other people have brought. I think in some ways because it's given people a chance to bring out something more of themselves and their characters.
Yeah,
just
sure.
Because it's a different
situation. It's a whole other layer of something that we've never really explored,
Yeah.
And I know for watching you and Maurice is absolutely heartbreaking and heart-wrenching, and you guys have such a great relationship. But so did Mark Teschner call you to do this?
I got a thing from my manager saying they've asked you to come in and read for this thing on a soap.
And what do you think about that?
I thought, for one thing, I'd been through, a number of different pilot readings, mostly different versions of a show that I actually just did a kind of quick thing the other night on called Cool Kids. But they brought me in a few times, but I couldn't find a handle on the character that I was reading for then. And so I was, going like, I had an appetite.
Mm-hmm.
And this came up, and it had they're really interested in you. So, and I had done a play in Hollywood a few years back about a gay playwright who, on the night of his first real production, his dad, he grew up in Tennessee, his dad shows up on the doorstep. It turns out his dad has got Alzheimer's.
Mm. Yeah, you were telling me about this.
He started to sort of wake up and realize that he's done something really not acceptable, he might harm somebody. He's a guy who pretty much was at home in the woods or at church. And he's come to ask his son to basically make sure that, he's going to, take him out before he hurts somebody.
Oh, wow.
So it was a very – so it gave me a time working on a play, working on those things, So it intrigued me in a way.
Yeah.
And I like that it was a matter of coming in and reading with the actor because this business of reading with somebody on tape.
It doesn't feed you so much.
So you don't get anything out of the experience of
the connection
reading. Whether you get it or not,
I know.
And then there's that tape out, people are watching something that you really wouldn't want anybody to see. And they're evaluating your work.
Yeah.
Right. I know. It's kind of crazy if you think about it.
So, and then I looked up Mo and I saw that, I saw some of his clips, and I saw this guy's got some.
He's going to yell at me.
He's got some passion.
And that he was bipolar and that his character was bipolar. There were all things that said, Go on in. And of course then there were, five other really good actors that I knew from, or had worked with, but so part of me went, don't go there.
Sure, that's a slippery.
And I read with Mo and then it worked out.
Because I remember him coming down after he read with Max. He was like, dude, this guy's great. He was on Barney Miller. I go, who? Who is it? Who is it? And so we Googled it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I know that guy. He's awesome. And so it's that's what you don't get from tape, is the connection that you guys have.
Yeah.
You can't, couldn't, if you hired a guy at tape and got here, and because I'll tell you, it happens a lot. It happened with him. He was supposed to be here for a couple weeks.
Uh-huh.
And it ended up being 12 years.
Uh-huh.
You know,
and that's the cool thing about this medium is that there is a collaboration, because if things percolate and things start to go in a different direction that everyone agrees can look around and go, hey, we like this, it can grow. You know, in primetime, you don't have – there's you have to chart it out so much that it's hard to go with something. It has to stay in the formula a little bit. But here, it can kind of take it on a life of its own as long as everyone's on board and willing to go with it a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's it's pretty neat in television specific, like that. I don't know where else that happens.
I don't either.
Yeah.
You know, I guess out on the road as musicians, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you can do that, but that's the coolest thing here is like you see stuff. You're like, man, this is working.
Yeah.
You know, and they see it and they go, okay, we're going to keep going.
Yeah.
You know, and further and dig further into the character and how it's affecting Carly and Sonny and everybody else around and the kids. And I mean, it's just been amazing, man. It's been so fun.
The people I've found that, you know, having spent a lot of time in the Indian world, but particularly if you're visible, the word gets out. So I have relationships with people throughout Turtle Island, you know, North America. But the people that have come out that I would have thought, they know me,
sure.
And then we might be connected on Facebook or something.
Right,
That I just wouldn't have imagined that they
watched
would be
General Hospital.
40-year General Hospital
It's
fans.
Amazing, right? Yeah, yeah. So one of the things that I'm curious about is I saw that you went to a small liberal arts college in northwestern Massachusetts.
Yes.
That my sister almost went to, Williams.
Uh-huh.
Go Eaves, I think, right?
Yes.
Eaves?
Yes.
Elephants? But
yes.
Shorts
no.
to Eaves?
Ephraim Williams was the guy that started Williams College.
Oh,
were the Eafmen.
The Eafmen.
And our mascot was a purple cow.
So there was no elephants.
I thought
no.
there were.
I just want to say that.
Yeah. It's a purple cow.
I know you just tried to kiss his ass a little bit.
Go Eaves. I had a Williams hat. Elephants. I had a Williams hat growing up when my sister went to visit it. I was like, this is a cool place. I got a hat. It was a Williams. It was a purple hat that said Williams. And I loved Williams. So did you do theater there? Did you work like in – there's so much great theater in like the Berkshires and that area.
Yeah, Williamstown is a big summer theater center.
Yeah.
No, I wasn't. The way that happened, I was an exchange student to Germany with the American Field Service my summer before my senior year. And on the way back in the band of college kids – they had a band, you know, for entertaining all these high school kids who had spent their summer in Europe. And the piano player – was also a wrestler. So he was an athletic guy, you know.
Goodness.
And he had kind of long
wrestling piano
shaggy hair.
Piano
this is not nowhere where long hair got to, but
right.
where I grew up, if it was like, you know, if the brush cut got any length
longer
at all, there'd be somebody tugging on it.
Sure.
Hey, getting a little shaggy there, aren't you, Max? You know?
Well,
and so he was a musician, because my friends over in Wyandotte across the bridge in the factory town of Wyandotte, which was mostly Polish and Irish.
Yeah.
You know, Tommy Moran and Billy Salamosi, and you know, that was a whole other realm from back on the island where I was playing sports and doing that stuff, and that really appealed to me. And I connected with a friend, and we hitchhiked back from New York when we landed, and we went and looked at Princeton, and we went and looked at Williams, because I never heard of it.
Yeah.
And that kind of appealed to me, that I'd never heard of it.
Okay,
so it didn't
yeah.
have all the negativity of Harvard and Yale and
okay,
all
sure.
those things, you know. So so that was it. It was just a step out into something that I had kind of found on my own.
I see. Okay.
Hitchhiking by all
yeah, it's like
ways
well,
of tra-
Did
my
you
dad,
sleep in any hostels?
That's what I was going to say. Bradford, maybe you can hitchhike back to Sacramento tomorrow and let us know how it goes.
It's called Lyft, but it's more expensive than it used to be.
I know. It's crazy because my dad hitchhiked from Indianapolis out to California.
Wow.
When he was 20 years old to come out here.
My dad hitchhiked when he was 11 with a friend, and they went from Michigan over to Niagara Falls and then came back via Canada.
Oh my god!
And in those days, that was like, it was a safe world too. I mean, I'm sure there were, but these days you don't want to let your kid, you know, out on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
I mean,
correct.
You know, it's very sad.
So your theater training,
mm-hmm.
Well, because the years that you were in college and then the years that you taught, and then all of a sudden you're on a really successful sitcom. And I'm trying to figure out what happened in between.
Yeah, okay. So I taught for 2 years.
Yeah.
And then I was I had fun with the students, but it was just it was an old faculty, and they loved that they taught. Anyway, it was done with it, you know. I was called out to Ann Arbor, University of Michigan, to see who was still accepting applications. And the one school that was still accepting applications was the business school. And I had ended up being an economics major at Williams, which just meant you took a few more courses in economics. But anyway, so I went to business school there. And after the first year, I had learned that if you showed up late for registration, because it happened to me once.
Yeah.
Then you didn't have to wait in line for those courses you wanted to get into or any of that, because it was, 30,000 students on the campus at the time, and that you could just go to the professor, Anyway, so I'm looking through what do I want to take out of the business school? Because you could take one graduate level course out of the business school. And say, it's an art course. Oh, art course. That's art school's right across the – you got to have a portfolio. And so you're looking – here's a course, Theory of Acting.
Theory of Acting.
Theory of Acting.
Oh, that's amazing.
It was the first, all the graduate students that came to Michigan, who I learned thought of themselves as, there's Yale and there's American Academy, and then there's us and Duke, and, they had their own idea of who they were.
Sure.
But I thought it meant that we'd look at movies and write papers.
Right. That sounds fun, yeah.
And so I went over to find the professor who was rehearsing a bunch of gals in a theater somewhere as the chorus for a Greek play they were doing.
Okay.
And I went with a friend of mine from I was playing on the Michigan rugby team. I'd been playing rugby Gene Cunit. And Gene was landscape architecture, but he played for a couple of years with the Steelers. And
oh my gosh.
A big curly haired, Russian Jewish background with a 52 inch chest and a 28 inch waist.
Wow.
And
he
was just an animal,
Yeah.
And so we went in, we sat in the back, and the guy says, can I help you? I said, wait until you're done. Finally, he couldn't help it anymore. He came over. He said, so what do you want? Well, I'd like to get in your theory of acting class. He says, are you a drama student? I said, no, I'm actually in the business school. He said, this is a graduate level course, have you done any theater? I said, not really, And Gino says, he's very talented. He plays the piano and he sings, and you just let him in.
I love that.
A ringing endorsement from
Gene. The guy says, okay, I don't know why. Maybe he wanted another guy in the class.
Right, the race.
It was a wonderful, a lot of the people who were in the class went on to have careers. And it gave me that experience of doing scenes. So then I moved out to San Francisco because I'd made it to the age of 26 and I didn't have to worry about being drafted anymore.
Ah.
And I had an old high school sweetheart out there, and there were a lot of things going on in San Francisco in 1969. Intriguing, So I went out there and I was doing piano bar gigs and trying to find. I was living with my.
Still playing those same three chords?
No. I had
progressed.
I loved diminished and augmented. I could play most of the songs that people would want to hear and sing to in a piano bar.
Sure.
And I wasn't so good that I was happy to get people singing.
Yeah, great. Yeah, sing for me, please.
That, And when I sang, it was usually something. Tall and tan and young and lovely, the girl with emphysema goes walking, and when she passes, he's one she passes, here's...
That's awesome. You learn that. We're going to take that on the road.
We sing a lot of parody songs on the road, and that's a new one for me. I like
good
it.
One.
So, but there was a stage play of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I had read that novel, right around that time. That and Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee were two of the, books that affected me a lot, just as far as what's going on. And these guys had taken a play. Kirk Douglas bought the rights from Ken Kesey. He did a play the same year Kennedy was assassinated. He had Dale Wasserman write the play, who went on to write the book for Man of La Mancha. It opened on Broadway. It played about 70 shows. It was kind of Nurse Ratched was a comic villain.
Okay.
You know, it was Billy Bibbit didn't commit suicide. I mean, I know most people don't know these characters, but there were departures from the book.
Right.
And these guys up in Marin had done an amateur production, and they had brought the half white, half Indian Chief Bromden in the play. He's the narrator of the book. You see everything through his eyes. And Kesey had come down on a writing scholarship at Stanford from Oregon. And he was working in a mental institution. But he was also one of a number of people. You know, the CIA was putting out acid in different circumstances, some to professors at Harvard and other places. And some they were paying students to take it. And some they were just dosing their own people and not telling them.
Right.
And so acid was working its way into the culture. And for Kesey, it was like he's kind of a night guard nurse, you know, on the floor at a mental institution. And that character came to him to a way to tell this story of you know, actually maybe the people in the nut house are not as nuts as the people who aren't.
Right.
So they'd done that, and the play opened up, and then they took it to North Beach, kind of.
And you were in it.
It opened up. It got great reviews. They were looking for understudies, and I happened to put an ad for understudy in the want ads. They were supposed to put an ad for people to run the snack bar and go to. Anyway, I happened to see it. I thought, that's interesting. I went down and auditioned for it. They said, you've got the, you know, you would be good. I thought I'd go down and read for McMurphy. But they said, no, you'd be good for the chief. Would you like to understudy the chief? What does that mean? Well, the guy might get sick, or he might want a night off, and you'll have to come down and kind of learn where there were places where they took passages from the book, and the lights would go dark, and a pin light would come up on the chief, and you hear this voiceover, you know,
right? Yeah,
and of his kind of catatonic. About 3 days later, before any of that checking out happened, I got a call. Can you be at the theater at 6:30? Because the guy playing the chief had an ongoing artistic conflict with the guy playing the character Harding, who was a character who was coming out as a gay man.
I love the artistic.
He was a very, very much into method, and it bothered him that this other guy, who was very technical, he didn't really cry, but he was so effective at it that he could, you know,
just
made, because the guy playing the chief was they were real tears, but sometimes there was so much snot coming out of his nose you couldn't understand anything. You know what I mean? It was just that.
And that guy would have been great on a soap.
He was a big method guy. It's funny on sitcoms, it's all about the laughs. On soaps, it's all about the tears.
Correct.
People come out joyfully out of the booth after a scene. Oh, you just had me crying.
It's
tears are healing. So.
Yeah.
So you know, it was like I was on.
You were thrust right in.
After the curtain call, as they were going down the stairs to where the dressing rooms were, he gave this tall crane of an actor a shove. You know, and the rest of the cast said, you know, we can't have this.
So the job was mine.
And I was really at a time in my own life of trying to figure out where am I going? And,
right.
And, so I found something in it, you know, and, over time, other actors came in and joined it. My friend Robert Walden came out to do a musical. Bobby was the first youngest actor ever in the Actors Studio. You know, I started to learn about acting.
Yeah.
And that it was more about taking the mask off than putting it on. Interesting. And learning. You know? So I stayed in the play for 2 years. And then I came down to, I thought, oh, I'm going to, before I go to, I think I was going to head toward Hawaii, but I'd like to check this out a little further. And I came down here, got involved with the Actors Studio, did a certain number of auditions, got a couple of little parts. They had opened up a production in New York, and they told me anytime if I wanted to go into it, I could.
Oh, wow.
I didn't give any thought at all until the night before I was going to take over the role. I was sitting in the audience watching the actor who had been given his notice. And I felt, you know, like a shit for 10 minutes, but because I just hadn't considered, you know, and so I did the play in New York and got some other little parts in movies.
What year was that about?
That would have been like 70.
So this is
73, 74.
Yeah. So Method was kind of, I don't want to say starting then, but it was Method acting was kind of thriving in that time, wasn't it?
I think so. You know, they're all kind of. I mean,
it comes in a big circle anyway.
With Lee, and then see other people who were saying this is what Lee said, and I said, well, it didn't sound like what Lee said to me, you know.
Sure.
I think, you know, nowadays it's kind of, you know, almost gotten a bad name, and maybe because of ways people have misinterpreted, whatever. You know, it's all about just opening up and connecting and finding something and sharing heart, right?
Yeah.
And I came back and I got sort of bootlegged into a friend's place out in Malibu Colony. I started running long distances on the beach and I started, these songs started coming to me that were not about, gee, this could be a hit song, but more like I think of them as my breadcrumbs in the cosmic forest.
Okay.
You know, something that we call, like, this is how I can kind of get what the best of my thinking about this and then be able to find it again.
Right.
You know, as opposed to have those great insights last night and all you got is a hangover. But one of the things got a call from my agent. Said, I don't know about this, Max. I don't know if you're interested, but it's a cop show because right. That's where everybody thought you should play a cop, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, but it's a comedy.
So we ended up talking to Max for almost an hour and a half.
I know it was a long time.
So we thought we'd cut him up. And episode 2 will be next week.
Yes,
so
for sure.
Can't get enough Max.
I know, man. Great stories. I love to talk to that guy.
So, but in the meantime, thought we'd interject
a tweet.
A tweet.
Well, because you did the song.
Well, it's the tweet.
So that's the clue.
It's the tweet of the week song. It's
Blues Clues.
Is it Blues Clues?
No. Blues Clues.
You know what? I put Blues Clues and Booze Cruise.
And you'd like to do both.
And I don't know. I love.
We're gonna have Stone Cold and the Jackal Blues Cruise,
dude.
Or Booze Cruise.
Can we do a Booze Cruise? Can be an SD&J Booze Cruise?
Well, it usually is when you're on the road anyway. So
we just gotta put it on a boat.
So it's just
we just gotta get a boat,
a rowboat,
a rowboat.
Me, you, and two other people.
Just toss in a rowboat.
Me, you, and Jeremy.
Just toss in a rowboat. Yeah. Booze Cruise.
Yeah, look what those idiots are doing over there. Where are they going?
Sponsored by Bartles and James.
Yeah. So, oh gosh, you want to throw up on the water?
Yes.
That's what you drink. Bartles and James. Do they still have Bartles and James?
I don't know, dude.
Do they still make wine coolers?
Seagram's does, I think.
They do.
Yeah.
Do people drink them?
Jeremy does.
That is true. He loves wine coolers.
Oh, just a little strawberry apple, strawberry kiwi. Just
I mean, he's so
beverage.
Funny because, you know, he didn't really drink that much until he met you.
I'm a good influence on most
no,
people.
No, I'm kidding. But he's not a big beer drinker. He doesn't like wine at all. Like, we could have a $300 bottle of wine, which we've never bought.
Right.
Or you would never buy it.
Well, there's so much
I'd buy
good
it
stuff
and
for
you
less.
Would drink it.
I would.
And
happily, thank you for that.
He's like, where's the Mike's Hard Lemonade?
Yeah, where's the good stuff?
The
break
Zima.
Out the, break out the good
the
stuff.
The Zima was the first good stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
And well, then Mike's Hard
it's
Lemonade.
It's clear,
and then,
refreshing, and delicious.
And then now when you guys go out, he'll be like, Bradford, just order me something. And when we were in Montreal, would you order him?
I ordered him a blood orange Cosmopolitan.
And he's so proud of it.
Oh, he loved it. I got a good
so
picture of
it. Did
yeah.
Oh, you did? That's
yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Let's read the tweet.
Okay. I think this was in response to, I think that this is actually, this was only a couple weeks ago, but it was in response to someone listening to Nancy's episode, I think.
Okay.
And this is in reference to you. When you get to talk to him, can you tell him to put on a different damn shirt, please? I'm tired of seeing him on my screen, and even more with the same damn black t-shirt.
Ouch.
Hey, hashtag Sam, want to buy your man a yellow t-shirt, please? So, you could be the man in the yellow shirt, and I could be Curious George.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say, because my daughter freaking watches Curious George all the time.
Oh, he's the man in the yellow hat.
Yeah, yeah, but it doesn't matter.
Man in the yellow shirt.
She watches all the time. I go, "This, what are you doing? This is not a good show." "Why, Dad? monkeys are not nice.
You say that same story to everybody, even your daughter. Your daughter must be so tired of that damn story.
Curious George is not a nice monkey. Don't let him fool you. He'll bite your fingers off.
Bite your fingers and toes off.
But that's so funny because I've seen that a few times on Twitter about why the black T-shirt.
Who introduced it? I mean, how did it
start?
Well,
then I saw someone tweet something like, oh, that's the reason he wears it? That's stupid. So the reason I started wearing it, and this is the reason, was I was on stage a lot, and it was always very hot.
So you just wanted to wear a T-shirt?
No. I wanted to wear something that I didn't sweat through all the time.
Oh, so you couldn't see the sweat marks.
Correct. Right. So as you notice, we're in my room, and I have two T-shirts hanging up right now, two black T-shirts, and I'm wearing one.
Yes.
Go figure. And, you know, so it started with, I'd have great.
Well, it was nice of you to put on a shirt. You did the whole thing with Max Gale shirtless. I thought it made him a little uncomfortable.
Yeah. But, it might sound like a dumb reason, but when you're changing shirts three or four times a day on set, I'm like, dude, just give me a black T-shirt. And then from that day on, it was always black.
That's so funny.
Isn't that awesome, though? Isn't it great? Listen, people get upset because I wear the same thing, but it's so identifiable now.
Yeah.
And it's easy.
It's your
jeans
calling card.
And T-shirt. That's it. That's what I wear at home. My wife's like, please, enough with the T-shirts. Like, I'll get Amazon packages.
Just black T-shirts.
10 black T-shirts. Every time we go on the road, I get 10 new ones.
Oh, it's awesome.
So I have 70 now here.
It's funny. My daughter was doing tell us about your family at school, and she wrote, my dad wears jeans and a T-shirt. Like, that's what he wears. So,
Mark, that's it.
Because in California, it's nice to layer because chances are it's going to be hot during the day, but it might be cool in the morning and it might be cool in the evening, but it's going to be hot during the day. So your base layer should be a T-shirt because you're going to get down to it at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But then in the morning, you might throw on a hoodie. And in the evening, the hoodie might come back on.
When it's 70, you'll throw the hoodie on. And when it's 68, you'll take the hoodie off.
My kids are ruined. It gets to be under 75, they have to wear a sweater to school because my wife's like, it's cold outside.
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's a horrible thing
yeah.
that Californians have done
yes.
to their people.
Yes.
I was at the beach
yeah.
the other night and a lady had a down jacket on. Dude, that's not right, man. I said, honey, are you kidding me? She goes, well, it is kind of cold. I go, what? What is wrong with you?
The years being in Nashville didn't change.
Oh, she hated it.
Oh, yeah.
Hate it. Because it got cold.
Well, sure.
It gets down. I mean, we had an ice storm.
It gets down to 50.
Zero.
Yeah. Well.
We had a few long winters. Last winter was a long winter. But she doesn't like the cold at all.
Right.
So even now, she's like, first of all, I don't even think it's gotten to 50 yet at the beach.
Right.
57.
Even
I gotta get a hoodie on. It's kind of cold. I go, are you being serious?
Do you remember in the springtime in the Midwest, in the Northeast, it would get above 55 and people would start wearing shorts?
100%.
Like April. As soon as you can feel the warmth of the sun.
100%.
Shorts come out.
Yes.
Because they're like, bring it on, I'm ready.
Totally.
And 55, like 55 in California is
winter coat.
Winter coat. And I think part of the reason is people are like, I have this really cool winter coat. When am I ever going to wear it? Oh, it's a blood.
Yeah, 16. I don't know about the science of the blood thinning in this whole thing. Is this correct?
I mean, I understand it. Like, I'm certainly more sensitive to extreme temperature cold than I used to be. When I lived in New York, it is so cold in New York with the wind, when the wind tunnels in between the buildings when you're walking.
Gosh.
And when cold air has moisture in it.
It's the worst.
It's just, right.
Dude, I grew up with Cleveland and Chicago.
Right.
It's the worst.
It's the worst. So when I was cold at that point in my life, cold would make me laugh. Extreme heat would make me angry.
I agree with you on the extreme heat.
Right. Extreme heat would make me angry. Extreme cold would make me laugh.
That's funny.
So it was easier for me to be extremely cold, and I didn't mind it so much. It was just like, oh my god, this is so cold. This is crazy. It's so cold.
I can't put enough jackets on.
Right. But then you go into a building, because it was always walking through New York. It was going to appointments, going to auditions. Right. If you're dressed for an audition, and you by the time you get there, you're a sweaty mess.
Of course.
You can't go back from that.
Right.
Right? If you go and it's freezing cold and you walk into your audition, you can come back from that. You can warm up.
Yeah. in the summer, you cannot come back from
it. You can't come back from it.
No. That's why you would wear black T-shirts.
Yeah, yeah, I guess you're right. I should have made that my uniform a long time ago.
Totally.
You're so smart.
I know I am.
God. It looks like such a simple thing, but there is just such a depth behind it.
I know.
The decision making is
discovery.
Just profound.
You're just discovering more and more about me every day.
Just you're an onion. We're just peeling back the layers.
Okay.
You're a blooming onion.
I'm a blooming onion. You're a fried onion.
You're a fried onion.
That I'm going to dip in mayonnaise. You fried.
So good.
You would love that, wouldn't you?
Oh. Yeah, I took Finola and I, we went out to dinner a couple months ago, and I took her to Outback, and I was just so happy.
You know, I believe I went to Mother's Day dinner at the Outback. My mom picked the Outback.
That's amazing.
No, I haven't been there since like 1984. It was amazing.
The
steak was actually pretty good.
They put a lot of salt and seasoning on it. It's going to be flavorful.
It was flavorful.
There was something very pleasing about the
that's
Outback.
That's funny.
Maybe.
I was very impressed. They had like the iPad you could order from.
Yeah, they're eliminating people from their equation.
So I'm not impressed that at all. But
you can get a
– they had actually a person to come over to teach you how to use the iPad.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is what you do. I go, so what are you doing here then?
Can't we just talk?
Can't you just write it down on your bad piece of paper?
Right.
Please.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well.
Blooming onion.
Well, we're excited to have another share our conclusion with Max Gale next week. And next week is our trip to Boston and Syracuse, which
Boston
is super cool.
Is awesome. We love Boston and Syracuse. I haven't been up to Syracuse for a long time, so I'm looking forward to that.
Maybe
it's a theater.
We can bring our fall jackets.
Bring a hoodie.
See some foliage.
That would be amazing
yeah.
to see some leaves change for sure. Well, you up in Sacramento, you guys got a lot of trees up there. I was very
– Yeah, we got trees.
Well
– No. It's a city of trees.
I know, but I was very impressed by the amount of foliage
I loved
up there.
Showing off our fair city to you and Jeremy.
It was
driving
great.
Some of those streets in the neighborhood.
It's amazing, dude.
Just the canopy of trees. It is
it's amazing.
Pretty amazing.
It is.
Yeah,
especially for California because you're not used to that here.
Right.
You're used to maybe a tree – every five blocks.
Right.
And then
very special
especially
tree.
Where I'm living now, it's very, I don't want to say deserty, but it can get,
yeah.
you know, well, we live in a desert,
well,
but.
Can you recall the last time it rained?
I cannot.
I can't. Six months?
I can't. It's horrible.
I mean, before,
by the way.
Before the summer.
I mean, the good thing is we're by the beach, so we get a lot of mist or dew or whatever
right,
it is
yeah.
coming off the ocean, which is amazing.
Yeah.
So it feels like a weather change. It feels like a season change a little bit. But yeah, rain, I have no idea.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
I miss it.
I know. I know.
So
October is coming up quick. Syracuse and Boston. And then January we got a good run down Charlotte, Atlanta, and then Florida's.
Yeah.
I call it the Floridas because we're doing four cities in Florida.
Four cities in Florida. The Floridas.
It's going to be fun.
Don't forget North Carolina and Georgia, though. We don't.
I did. I said that.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I don't know if you were listening. You have headphones on, don't you?
I think I do.
Open your ears. So, can't wait to see you guys. Thank you, as usual.
Yes. Good time, as always.
Yeah, go again, please. If you have not gotten on the list at stonecoldandthejackal.com for information and dates.
It
please,
really helps. There's
please.
A lot of
it helps so much. It
well,
helps.
It helps us too.
It helps us from having
because
to
you guys write back to
people.
Us on Twitter being like, you guys are going to Boston, and inevitably that will happen. We'll play Boston on Saturday, and then
guaranteed it will happen.
And then on Monday, people are like, when are you coming to Boston?
On Sunday,
when are you coming to Boston?
When are you coming to Boston? We were just there.
Yeah. How come I didn't know about it?
Oh,
because you're not on the list.
Get on the list. So
well, and then I guess when you get the list. We try not to spam you. We try not to like send so many emails so that the ones that we do send you
have meaning.
Have meaning and you read them. So, because that's also part of it too. You got to read them, I guess. Right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I just should have every subject line of our emails be shirtless pick up Steve.
Yeah. No, don't do that. So, cool, man. We'll finish up with Max Gale next week. Hope you guys have a great week. Thank you.
All right.
You.
Talk to you later.
All right.
Bye.